Okay, over to Master of Ceremonies.
Master of Ceremonies, oh yes, Megasuga. The Buddha's word of love and kindness. This is what should be done
by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living here and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with her mother's heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, with your heart at one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
A car coming.
Yep.
We'll do the polite thing and start without them. Please have a seat. We're yet to start. So, yeah, tonight is my last night, as far as Mondays are concerned. Next week, Venerable Kasapa will be leading the meditation. So, I'll just say that if I have said anything which has upset or offended anyone, then I ask for your forgiveness. It was not my intention. And I hope that you've got some benefit out of the Dhamma that we've spoken about during these last 4 or 5 weeks. So, what makes a good curry or a stew? For those who are chefs amongst you, there could be a couple of answers. Someone would say it's the ingredients. Some might say it's the way you cook it. It's the chef that makes the curry. But what is it that makes a curry? We get various ingredients that go into the boiling pot, the cooking pot. We might have some beef or some chicken. We might have some spices. We may have some vegetables blended according to a recipe. And each curry that we make tastes slightly different to the one that we had before, because we don't quite get the recipe perfectly right the same every time. But the thing with that is, when you taste the curry, when it's been made, it seems to have a taste of its own, a taste which is different to any of its unique ingredients. Putting all of these ingredients together gives us the impression that there is a new taste, a blended taste, which is the result of putting all of these ingredients into the cooking pot and heating them over the stove. Human beings are like that. We're born into this world. We have form. We have a body. We have arms and legs, torso, head. We have organs which keep this body functioning. We have a mind, we have feelings. We have perception, we recognize things. We think thoughts. And we have consciousness. And all these things go into the melting pot. And what comes out is a human being which seems to be a bit more than all of those parts put together. But in reality, it's an illusion. Because when we pull all the parts apart, there's nothing left. It's like the banana tree. When you start peeling away the trunk, you peel away and peel away and peel away and peel away, and in the middle there's nothing. But through delusion, we don't see that. We see ourselves as a being. We see others as beings living in this world. But what are we living for? What is this curry we call a human? What drives it? We all take care of our body to some degree or another. If it's cut, we put on a band-aid or whatever it might be. If it's hungry, we eat. If thirsty, we drink. But to what end? The body consists of parts of its own. It consists of elements. But when you think about it, we are predominantly concerned with our senses, with what we see, what we hear, what we taste, etc., down to what we think. That's because we're born into what we call the sensual realm, or a sensual realm. Humans are part of the karma loka. And from a Buddhist cosmology perspective, that they are the realms in this particular sphere are involved in the senses. They experience the world through senses. They take pleasure and pain through the senses. Above the karma loka is rupa loka, or beings that are a form but don't rely on the senses, where their mental activities are much more refined and enjoyment comes, but they still have a body. Then above that there's the arupa loka, where beings have no body at all, they're simply mental energy. But they still experience suffering. But back to humans. Think about it. Our primary objective as we go through life is to find some sort of either relief from our suffering, from our pains, from our the burden of aging, cold, sickness, flu, COVID, bad knees, bad hips, bad arms, headaches. We're either trying to avoid those, which we experience through the senses, or we're out looking for sensual pleasure by things that we like to look at, things that we like to see, watching a movie, watching whatever it may be that turns us on, listening to pleasant sounds, listening to some music, smelling sweet perfume. These are the things that we really want our body to do. I mean, do we really care that we've got a liver? Do we wake up every morning and think, oh, I must do something for my liver? It's really important to me. I mean, if you didn't have to have the liver to cleanse your blood and do all the other functions that it did, would you really care? If you didn't have your spleen, would you really care? If it wasn't supporting the senses, which parts of your body are... If they were not supporting the senses, which parts of your body would you gladly get rid of? I mean, you've got a gut. But really, if you didn't have to eat, would you really want it? If you could just savour the food and that was it and you didn't need it to grow and for energy, would you really care about your gut? Do you really care about your toenails? Some people do, especially the outside. They care a bit about their hair, they care about their skin, they care about all the things they want to look nice. There's plenty of people like that. But really, how important are those things? Because even people who care for those things, who for which the body is, to them is important, they want to have a nice look, fit, whatever it might be. They do so because they want to be sensually attractive to somebody else. In other words, they want to spike interest in someone else's eyes, in someone else's ears, in someone else's nose. So they do it for the senses, it's just not their senses that they do it for. But really, we do it because, we probably care a little bit about our bones and a little bit about our muscles because they allow us to move. Because let's face it, if we're stuck in one spot all the time, it rather puts a dampener on the amount of sensual experience that we can savour, that we can experience. So we like to get around. We don't want to be stuck. We don't want to be bored by staying in one spot all the time. Only meditators do that. Now, people in general, they want to be off doing things, experiencing things. And how do they experience things? They do it through their senses. So this melting pot, which is a combination of mind and body, we treat it as a mobile sense machine, basically, where we go around trying to experience pleasant things and avoid unpleasant things. And whether we like it or not, from the time that we get up in the morning to the time that we go to bed at night, that's the predominant driver of most of us, from the day we're born to the day we die. And most of us never stop to give a single thought to that. But from a Buddhist perspective, all we do is see what we churn out as a human being, which we identify as me and mine. We see that as a cause for suffering, as the basis for suffering, because of our attachment to the body, to the senses. When we're attached to things that we like and they disappear, we experience suffering. We dislike it. When we experience things that we are averse to, that we don't like, then we experience suffering. And when the Lord Buddha became enlightened, that's the thing that he was enlightened too, if you like, or that was what he came to know. He came to know suffering and its cause. And he worked out how to eliminate the cause. And by eliminating the cause, he eliminated the effect and his suffering was gone. And he taught the Noble Eightfold Path as the way to follow him. So basically he's saying, I've done this, I've got there. If you follow this path, you'll be treading in my footsteps. And you too can attain enlightenment and freedom from suffering. So we have to look at this curry that we call a human being. Look at it and see it for what it is. That it is built up of parts, heated by a heart which is deluded, that's always grasping, always wanting to go out and find more, more sensual pleasure here, more sensual pleasure there. because that's the nature of being a human being. But a practicing Buddhist swims against the tide. A practicing Buddhist doesn't accept the conventional view of the world, because accepting the conventional view of the world just leads us back to where we started: birth, old age, sickness and death. And if we want to avoid suffering in the future, then we have to make some changes to our life. And the changes that we have to make are all the components of the Eightfold Path, or split into three: it's virtue, calmness, concentration, and wisdom. Wisdom comes first, despite the fact that we often say that the lower levels of purifying our mind are generosity and virtue, and wisdom's the highest. You need some wisdom to start practicing in the first place. You need some wisdom. It has to have dawned on you a little bit that this life is suffering, because if that hasn't dawned on you yet, then why would you practice? Why would you even consider what is driving your curry? So practice starts really with right view. A view of what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. So that with some mindfulness you can start to train your mind to eliminate and not get involved with the unwholesome traits that you may have in your mind, and to develop some of the wholesome ones. Then you're starting to now make a different kind of curry. Now you've got some different ingredients. Now you can start to think, well, maybe I should also start to meditate. I should keep my five precepts: not kill, not steal, not be sexually promiscuous, not tell lies, not take intoxicants. Basic stuff. Then maybe you think, oh, I can also try some meditation. Try to calm this mind that's driven by the fires of lust, aversion, hatred, greed, delusion. And then maybe I can add in a touch of wisdom for good measure. Now we're starting to turn the ingredients around a little bit, so that the ingredients now start to make a curry which is not the same as the ones that the normal people have made. And as we practice in this way, developing our virtue, developing our morality, developing calmness, developing loving kindness and compassion to other beings, seeing the suffering in daily life, then we can jump out of the boiling pot, jump out of the melting pot, and be free from the heat of the oven. If we don't practice in this way, then we're doomed to feel the heat of the hot plate. Forever, life after life. So it's important to reflect on what it is that we call me and mine. It's important to see that the human being is just made up of different parts. And there's the illusion of a self, just the same as there's the illusion of the curry, that it tastes different to all its ingredients. But the taste of the curry doesn't last forever. And there's no reason why you can't break the shackles which have held you back for countless lifetimes. And you can do that if you practice in the right way, with right view, right understanding. Enlightenment is open for all of us. It doesn't discriminate, but it's only there if you practice. It's only there. Freedom from suffering is only available to those who put in the effort with the right attitude. But it's still possible. You who are in this room have come across the Dhamma. The opportunity for you is still there. It's up to you how hard you practice. It's up to you how much you want, how much heat of the hot plate you're prepared to put up with. No one can do it for you. But all I ask is that you try. And that's all from me. So we'll sit in meditation now. So, in this boiling pot that we call the human body, the scientists amongst us will know that about 73% of this body is water. But to look at it, you wouldn't think that the majority of the body was water. Another illusion, you could say. But here's something that you might want to try. Before you actually start your meditation and you want to feel comfortable, just feel yourself sitting on your chair or on your cushion, on the floor, however you're seated. Feel yourself sinking into that cushion, that chair. Now imagine the body is just water, just the water element. And now there's no form. It's just a big puddle sitting where you were sitting before. Just see the body slowly sinking down, dissolving in front of you. Dissolving and just becoming water. Just feel that body slip away. And the water has no tension other than a bit of surface tension. It's just a puddle where you're sitting. Just focus your attention on that water and let your mind become calm. Just see yourself now, no body, just a puddle of water. And then when your mind is calm then you can turn your attention to your own meditation subject, or you can just stay with a puddle of water. practice, we're gradually coming towards the end of our practice. Those of you who still have that puddle of water firmly planted in your mind, see that puddle rising up and starting to take form. Starting to take the shape of your posture. With a rest, just start to feel that relaxation. Don't judge whether you've had a good session or a bad meditation session. Just be content that you've put in some effort. Start to come around in your own time. Time. So, I'll try and see if anyone has got any questions. Anyone at all? Come on, Jude, it's your turn. It's about time.
I did last week at the beginning.
You did. That's absolutely true.
That was a big one.
Sorry?
That was a big one.
Right.
My mum had a stroke about 2 days ago and she's suddenly become a completely different type of person than the person I've been all my life. You know? So I'm kind of wondering how I can deal with that. If you've got any advice, or it's not exactly a question.
I was saying earlier, only 6 years ago, my wife had a very severe stroke, but it didn't really change her personality. Thing is, you're attached to the way she used to be.
Mm.
And if you're always attached to that, you're going to be unhappy. And so will she, if she's attached to the way that she used to be. So, you have to accept how she is now. And you have to love her for what she is now. And have compassion for her because she's suffering. Mm. You want her to be free from suffering.
Yeah.
And if she's attached to the way she was rather than the way she is, she will suffer. And you will suffer too. If you're always thinking of the past and thinking, if only she was, you know, will she be better? Will she do this? Will she or won't she? It's a daily proposition. And you have to accept that, that she's as she is. And for you, you can have the opportunity to see suffering. Now, this is first-hand experience because someone you love, someone you treasure, you have to realize they can't bring you happiness. It seems like they can, because we place all our wishes and our desires in the outside world, hoping that we will find something that brings us happiness. And one of the first things that we encounter as we're growing up is our family, and in particular, the love of our mother. And, you know, some people lose that over the years, but most people don't. Most people still end up loving their mother. And it's good to look after mother and look after father, because the Lord Buddha said, even if you carry your your mother and father on your shoulder for the rest of your life, the rest of their lives, and on there they defecate and they eat and they do everything, they don't get off your shoulder, that burden is still not enough to repay the debt you owe them for the birth that they gave you into this life. So looking after mother and looking after father is important. But if she's changed in a way that, you know, you having difficulty coming to grips with, then you have to just try and let go of the past, of what she used to be like, and only think of what she is and love her for what she is.
She hasn't exactly changed. She's just kind of disappeared.
Still changed. Mm. You know, disappeared. Wherever she is, wish her happiness.
Mm.
Wish her to be free from suffering. And wish yourself to be free from suffering. Because if you cannot wish yourself to be free from suffering, you cannot wish other people to be free from suffering. Metta, which can't be the Metta Sutta. It's not the same as sending metta. Everyone thinks, well, not everyone, lots of people think that it's like a radio wave. You send it out and it goes everywhere. Metta doesn't work like that. Metta's like this cup, like this glass. This is my heart. The glass is metta. I take water and pour it in and fill up my own jar of metta, eventually that water will spill out and go everywhere. And that's what you have to do when you practice metta. You have to make metta in here for yourself, and then it will go out to other people. Does that help? Good. Anybody else?
I was just going to say that the brain is very plastic and it can adapt and change. It may have been injured initially, but it can make a difference. Time is amazing when it comes to the healing process.
Yeah. And bear in mind that what you're healing there is really, there's the body and there's the mind-body interface. The brain is really like that, like the mind-body interface. It's like the Thich Nhat Hanh used to talk about it as if it was the head office. It rules the roost where the body's concerned, but it's it in itself. You know, the corpse has a brain, but it doesn't function. The mind, the mental component is gone. And your mum, you don't know what her mental situation is. She can't communicate with you. But that doesn't mean to say that she doesn't understand. From an outside perspective, it may look like she's gone, but it doesn't necessarily mean that she has gone. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's over to the Master of Ceremonies again now. We're right on time for once.
Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all the virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life, may they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless, through the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana, in every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, and surpass is the protection of the Dharma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all of these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.